least the good news is asset prices have been rising. But how much further will they go? Will we hit new highs, or are we due for a consolidation here shortly? Joining me on the program from Asbury Research is John Kozar. John, I want to begin our discussion with two different sides of what's going on in the market. You've got this V-shaped recovery that we're seeing in stocks since we hit a bottom, and then we're talking about maybe a U-shaped recovery if the economy comes online. You and I were talking before we went on the air, is if they bring the economy back, are people going to jump on airplanes, start going out on a regular basis, and start going to movies or gyms? And so I wonder if we might talk about that, because it seems like there's a dichotomy between the two.
There totally is. And there usually is. We just see this one more because it's such an extreme situation with COVID. You don't get paid in the stock market by trading the economy, because although they're ultimately the same thing, they run on different speeds. The economy is day to day. There's new information coming out. There's new talk with governors talking about opening. And then there's the stock market, which is a discounting mechanism that, depending on who you talk to, it discounts the economy 1 to 3 quarters ahead or more, than that. So they're two different, they're related, but they're really two different animals. And we don't get paid on what the economy does. We get paid on what the stock market does. So for us, our shop, what we do, nothing has really changed. We're just following the money. We're following the data, and we're trying not to outsmart ourselves. Keeping it simple in that way. During these times, a quantitative approach, a data-driven approach, really has its advantages, because you can kind of move away from the din of information that's in your face every day, and you could just look at the numbers, and that's what we do.
And let's speak of those numbers, because we had a lot of money coming out of the bond funds. We had a lot of money recently going into energy funds, like the USO ETF. And then we have a lot of money going to gold. So as you look at these money flows, John, what are they telling you? Where's the money going?
Gold has been one that we've been watching. Frankly, we've had our hands full just trying to keep up with the stock market. There's just been, everything's been faster. Everything's, been kind of turned up a couple of notches in terms of speed. What I have been watching is GLD, gold, and I'm actually getting over there now so I can speak to the chart. Gold does not follow futures. It follows gold bullion, as your listeners probably know. But what I noticed was maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, I started seeing assets trending back into GLD. We look at the total net assets. We track total net assets in about 100, 150 ETFs. That range from gold to interest rates to stock indexes and so on and so forth. But about a few weeks ago, I noticed the flows started to turn positive again in GLD. We had broken a really big overhead resistance level. We first did it back, I'm looking at the chart, back in February, and then we came back down to the 200-day moving average in March, and now we're moving higher. It's trading at 162.57 right now. We've got a target on gold of 174. And now that we've cleared this major resistance level around 147 or 148, as long as those asset flows keep coming into gold, I think we're going to see that 174 number sooner rather than later. I think we could see it in the next month or two.
Wow. And if we break out and you hit those kind of levels, does it just, you see a pullback, you see consolidation, or is that the sign that you could actually even go higher? In other words, a breakout to levels like we saw, I'm trying to think of going back to 2011.
Yeah, what usually happens is the market's a lot more sophisticated now than it was 20 years ago because of people's access to more information over the internet. Most places that you would invest in, big shops, small shops, everybody has access to some kind of charting software. Even though it might be simplistic, people understand those levels more. And I think it's been a self-fulfilling prophecy to a degree in terms of, in some senses, I think basic technical analysis tools, support and resistance targets work better now because there's more people looking at them. There's more people that understand them. It's more of an accepted way to manage your portfolio than it was 30 years ago. So Where I'm going with that is I'm not the only guy on earth that knows how to read charts. I think if we get up to that 174 area, what I've noticed is once I get close to a target that I've measured, you know, by looking at a chart, I really start to watch those flows, because those flows will tell you if there are people taking profits up there. So that's what I would be doing. If we get up into the low 170s, now I'm looking at those flows every day to see if they start to deteriorate, which would mean there's people taking profits, people ringing the cash register up there. At that point, you know, you may elect to do the same, wait for a good break to buy, and then watch for those flows to come back into the market. That's how we do it here. I think it makes sense. It's data driven. And if this economy is going to be as slow to come back as many of us, including myself, think is going to be the case, it makes sense to me that this trend and goal isn't going to go away. There's still going to be people that are looking for alternative investments to the stock market.
Let's talk about another sector of the market, and I want to talk about technology, and especially the FANG stocks, the Amazons, the Microsofts, the Googles. They seem to be holding up and driving a lot of what was happening in the market. And I was reading, John, if you back out, you know, the FANG stocks out of the S&P, it doesn't look as good.
Oh, yeah. That's a really good place to go in terms of the interview here. What I do is, I'm sure what a lot of people do, after the market suffers a big hit like we have, you're looking at the large capitalization, typically tech stocks, because they tend to lead. They tend to lead up and down. So you want to see how they're performing outright. You want to see how they're outperforming relative to the S&P 500. And I just pulled up a chart here of Microsoft, because that has been one, along with Intel, that's been one of my poster children that I've been watching here. Microsoft, price activity in Microsoft over the past 3 weeks has been really constructive. I actually have a chart pattern here that targets a move to 198, which would mean a new all-time high. It doesn't mean, just because there's a price target, it doesn't mean we have to hit it. But when you're looking at the stock market, especially after it's taken a big hit like this, and you're looking for, you know, you're turning over rocks to try to see some indication of where the market's leaning. It's leaning higher. I've actually got a relative performance chart here of Microsoft versus the S&P 500. And it first started outperforming the S&P on a 21. This actually goes even back further. It started outperforming back around Thanksgiving. It started outperforming the S&P 500 on a monthly basis. It keeps doing that. So I'm looking at Intel. I've got a price target in Intel. There's other ones. So yeah, the tip of the spear, as I like to call it, looks healthy, targets higher prices. I'm looking at I've got a target of 68.50 in Intel. We're at 59.78 right now. So I don't understand it. I see the same things you do. You know, businesses are closed. I wonder how they're going to reopen. How do you open up a restaurant when you can only have half the amount of tables there? You know, there's all of this stuff crosses my mind. But again, I'm not getting paid to try to handicap, you know, the restaurant business or the airline business. I am getting paid to try to follow the money in the stock market. And right now, while we're talking, our models turn back to positive. We have two tactical models. They turn back to positive, one on April 7th, one on April 9th. And I've got some targets in some of these bellwether tech stocks that suggest that we're going to take a run at the old highs. It doesn't make sense to me. But again, I'm just following the data.
And let's talk about your Asbury 6. This is a key group of indicators that you use. What is the Asbury 6 telling you right now?
The Asbury 6, I'm actually getting over there as we speak. The Asbury 6 are six separate indicators that we basically backtested would have been my favorite indicators after being in the business for 40 years this year, quantitatively tested them to say, how do we take these indicators, throw the ones out that are just redundant to others, and keep those that are a little bit different, where all six of those will give you kind of a six-sided look at the stock market and will work well offsetting false signals or incorrect signals in some of the six. And we came up with these six, and they have been positive since April 7th. Actually, if you go to our website, there's a sample there under models, and you could take a look at those. But they went to positive on April 7th. All six are currently positive. Of the six, only one of them is based on price alone. It's the monthly rate of change in the S&P 500. The other five are not based on price because with algorithmic trading being whatever it is, 75, 80% of the daily volume in the stock market, there's a lot of choppy false moves on a day-to-day basis that you see in the S&P 500 and other indexes. People who trade these things every day know that. They seem to run the stops up and down, and sometimes just focusing on price isn't enough. So we, five of the six are stuff like flows into the spider, high-yield corporate bond spreads, on-balance volume, other stuff like that. So we're obviously, we get paid on price on what the S&P 500 does, but I'm focusing more on under-the-hood indications of the day-to-day condition of the market and not so much on the tick-by-tick movement in the S&P 500 anymore, frankly.
Another question, as you've been speaking here, have you ever seen movements this quick and this often in the market in your career?
Boy, that's a good question. I was on the trading floor in the S&P 500 pit during the crash in 1987, and I could still see images in my head of what that looked like. And if you're on the floor, everything's amplified, right? Because every, you know, there's thousands of people there jumping, crying, laughing, pushing, shoving. It's like a John Wayne movie on steroids that day. But I don't I think that this was nastier, faster. Again, you know, it's easy to say, oh, yeah, you know, the trading floor was the most, just because I was there. If you're physically there, it seems like it's, you know, bigger and better and badder than it was. But I think this move down was the quickest. Let's put it this way. I try to judge everything quantitatively. Going into that weekend, February 21st was a Friday. I think four or five of our Asbury six were positive. By the close on Monday, all six were negative. And I never saw those metrics turn all at the same time that fast. We're looking at corporate bond spreads and relative performance charts, all these diverse measurements of the market that I put together so I wouldn't have them all turn at the same time. You know, they're all a little bit different. They all turned on a dime that Monday, which was the 24th. And then if you recall, the market opened on Tuesday, relatively unchanged from Monday's close. And then that was it. It was straight down. You know, within what, just a few weeks, we got down to the late March lows.
You know, the thing that strikes me, John, and it's really hard to believe, and I think what we've just gone through is going to be one of those seminal events that is going to change a lot of things. You know, we're talking about when we come out of this, what's it going to be like for people getting on airplanes? What's it going to be like going to a restaurant, a gym, a movie theater? A lot of that is going to change. And the thing that really strikes me about this, it's hard to believe, 2 months ago, the markets were at record levels. The unemployment was the lowest we've seen in six decades. Global economies were picking up and growing, and here we are 2 months later, we're talking about double-digit unemployment. Unemployment claims now, I think, are 22 million or more, and they're talking about one of the biggest contractions in the shortest period of time that we've seen in history.
Yeah, these are times. I've been doing a lot of thinking about this because if you want apples to apples comparison, you know, we had a pandemic in 1918. There's a PBS special. I'm a big fan of PBS, and there's an American Experience special that talks about that. I watched it twice. I found it on the internet and watched it twice just to try to understand how it was then and how people reacted. Obviously, it was a completely different economy. It was 100 years ago. There was no internet. It was still an industrial society, a farming society back then. And then I realized trying to measure, I should just be looking at fear, greed. I should, because that's something that no matter what the event is, you know, whether it's, you know, the financial crisis or the 87 crash or the tech bubble, going across, the fear should stay constant. So I looked at a lot of indicators like, you know, the percentage that the S&P is trading below the 200-day moving average, breadth statistics, volatility. And there's about a half a dozen of these, and they're all at levels, if you go back 30 years, that have all coincided with major bottoms. Sometimes there was a secondary bottom. If you go back to 07, when all these extremes hit, that first bottom was November 2008. That's when you saw the big spike in the VIX and percentage of S&P percentage underneath its 200-day moving average, all those things I just mentioned. And then you didn't get the final bottom until March of 09. So we could very well have another retest or make a new low in here and maybe not have a bottom until Labor Day or Thanksgiving. I don't know. I can't. I'm not a fortune teller, but I try to measure fear rather than try to handicap COVID, which is impossible. I mean, I don't think anybody can do that.
Yeah. I mean, we have no idea, even if they open up the economy. You know, I imagine if you've been staying in your house for 6 weeks or 2 months, you probably might want to go out and do a few things. But I think people's behavior is going to change. And still, John, we don't even know if it comes back again when flu season starts up at the end of September. What do we do then?
So, yeah. No, that's right. And you know, the other thing I was thinking too is the one thing that really amazes me is the durability of, you know, the economy and of, you know, ingenuity. It's going to be different. It's going to change things. But while some businesses are going to never come back or come back in a different way, other businesses are going to thrive. Look at Netflix. I mean, that's just the one that comes to mind. But when this is over, there are going to be smart people in American business that are going to see the world has changed, and they're going to be able to get out in front of it, and they're going to figure out ways to make this work in their favor, and life will go on, and our world will change, and it'll be different. But, you know, I have a lot of confidence in, you know, the ability of people, companies, in being able to adapt. And I think that's going to be the interesting part going forward.
Yeah, I could see that. I mean, you're seeing it with Netflix. Take a look at Amazon. Even take a look at the big box stores like Walmart, Target, Costco, that have developed a sophisticated online presence. I mean, I'm even looking at Best Buy. I needed to order something, and they meet you out front with your orders. So you don't even have to go in the store. You order it online and pick it up.
Yes, that's what I was talking about. People still have money to spend. People still have to eat. People still want to be entertained. All of the needs are there. It's just how we satisfy those needs is going to change. And the smartest and the fastest are going to win, and our world will go on, and it will change. You know, it's going to certainly make picking stocks and picking companies to invest in a lot more. I mean, we're a data-driven shop, and we're watching money flows. But I mean, there's going to be a lot of really smart people out there that are going to be able to get ahead of this by 2 years. And that's going to be your next big business. Maybe it's going to be your next Apple. I mean, not, you know, necessarily in that business, but the next several businesses that are going to really be the, you know, the leaders, you know, the 800-pound gorillas might be those that are smart enough to look ahead and forecast how our society is going to change.
Listen, John, as we conclude here, I'm picking up a couple things. Your Asbury 6 are all on positive mode. The tip of the spear, the techs are leading, and you expect them to go higher. And you also expect gold to go higher. So as an investor, is that where you would focus your attention?
I think so. But I think you've got to be really nimble here. I don't think, certainly set it and forget it is going to be very difficult here. I think the risk is you say, okay, I think there's a bottom in place. So you buy the market, and then we go back and revisit those lows, or maybe we take them out by another 5 or 10%. And then we get our bottom in September. And then 6 months later, you know, the country has adapted. American businesses are starting to adapt, and you know, the market can see that. So you just really have to be careful to get your timing right. I don't know that you go all in here. I think, you know, you separate your money into buckets. You know, maybe you participate here, and then you keep some dry powder in case we do drop another 10 or 15%, and you can put more money to work. Or ideally, if we rally 15% more, then now you can average up. But I just think you got to be really careful about having a good long-term idea and poor near-term timing.
All right. Well, listen, John, as we close, if listeners would like to find out more about the work you do at Asbury, how could they do so?
The best way, I think, is we have a bi-weekly market update, you know, that we put out. It's free of charge, and this is kind of how we introduce people to what we do. You sign up for that by going to asburyresearch.com, asbury research.com, and you could either go to the contact tab and ask to be put on the, you know, the free list, or on the landing page. You can actually, if you scroll down a little bit, there's an orange button there and you can sign up. It comes out every 2 weeks, and you can have a look, see what we do, and it won't cost you anything, and we'll see what happens from there.
All right. Well, listen, John, stay safe and come back and talk again.
Great to talk to you, Jim. See you next time.